This is the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast. With your host, Joe Maga.
Wow. Did you watch that? We did. That was not the most exciting Manchester derby we've ever seen. But we're here to talk about it anyway. This is the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast. I'm Joe Lago, editor of the FC Yahoo blog. And here with me is Alex Baker.
How's it going, Joe?
Just trying to have a little coffee. It's
all right. We can get some coffee later. Reprising his role as producer extraordinaire, Joey Gallino.
There's not enough stuff I can do in post-production in the world to make this Manchester Derby interesting.
And, of course, we got Leander Charles Atkins on Skype from New York.
What?
Yeah, we need to wake up. That was... So, I would say this was a Jose Mourinho special. He knew what he needed going into the Etihad against Manchester City to keep the status quo. He was there to get a point. He got it. For most of the game, he had pretty much everyone behind the ball. Maybe Marcus Rashford was looming, looking for to get hit on the counter. But it was classic Mourinho, guys. And it's funny, some of the comments, you know, after the game, he said they actually tried to play some attacking football, which was a complete lie because he was just there to get a point. And, you know, Manchester City dominated. They had 70% possession. They had a 10-2 shots advantage at halftime. It ended up being 19-3 at the end. Sergio Aguero had some missed chances. But, I mean, can you fault Mourinho in the way he set up United? Because Zlatan was out, Pogba was out, and Mata was out.
You got to play to the strengths of the team you have available. And, you know, he's got his top scorer out. It's a difficult away fixture against a team that was probably most people's favorites to win this. So, you know, Mourinho has proved that he might be having the season people thought he would with United. But when it comes to the big games, he's pretty much got it right. He got it right against Chelsea. And you got to say he got it right today because this result suits Manchester United much more than it suits Man City.
Yeah, from that perspective, the way they started the match was interesting. I think Mourinho, at the risk of defending him, gets a little bit of undue criticism for the way he sets up in these big away matches because it's rarely ever pack everybody behind the ball from moment one. And today there was a little bit of experimentation. It looked like you had Rashford sitting out to the right, and Mkhitaryan was almost like a false nine, even though he was a little bit deeper. You couldn't quite call him that. But he was playing centrally, and Martial was out to the left. And it was kind of just this weird look that they had to go to, basically, because of what you said, Joe, about the injuries. But very soon, Rashford kind of drifted back centrally. And then, yeah, as the game grew on, you know, he selected Carrick. He selected Fellaini and had him play a little bit deeper. His night ended early, which we'll talk about, I'm sure, here in a second. But for the most part, they did play a little bit more defensively in a bit of a shell, and by the second half it was just full on nine guys behind the ball, plus De Gea was excellent in a couple key moments, and you had Rashford up top to maybe nick a sporadic goal. So, you know, once Mourinho kind of found out, yeah, maybe they had a couple early chances in the first half, and once those fizzled out, it became full on just survival mode and get this point, because like you said, it is a better point to get for United than it is for City.
It doesn't take a real deep dive into the statistics to sort of understand where Mourinho was coming from here. Of the top seven teams, everybody has scored between 60 and 70 goals except for United. They've only scored 50. Yet they've conceded the second fewest goals of anybody in the league, 24, which is only two more than Tottenham. So between that, between the injury to Ibrahimovic, between the trouble that Mourinho himself concedes that they're in, this was a credible point for them. And, you know, he knew it wasn't going to be pretty, no matter what he said. But if he was going to get a point, he would have to park the bus. So, you know, it was in that sense, maybe it was a little bit predictable in retrospect.
When Fellaini lost his head by headbutting Sergio Aguero, I think he was trying to explain to the ref that nothing had happened. But I think the assistant referee confirmed that there was contact. And the replays clearly show that there was contact. Here's United executing this defensive, you know, game plan to get out of there with a point. And then Fellaini loses his head. And obviously Mourinho was not happy with it because he was giving him an earful as he walked off the field.
I would take this tape and I would show young players, this is how you draw and sell a red card on somebody in an intense match. You wait for one of the most mentally weak players on the United side, Marouane Fellaini, to be upset about something. And then Aguero's acting job, this was an A-plus acting job by Aguero. He sold that headbutt. I'm sure there actually was probably a little bit of contact, because Fellaini, even though he's a lot taller than Aguero, like, reached down with his head pretty far. But even if there wasn't, Aguero went straight back. And that's, you know, it could have turned the match. It didn't ultimately turn the match, but when you're that late and you need a goal, you know, why not explore every option available to you? And if one of the United guys is going to put himself in that position, why not try to take advantage?
The footage, I think, was conclusive. There was definitely contact. It was a full-on headbutt. But to make a larger point about Fellaini, who is Belgian, and so I sort of saw him come up in his career, early on, there was hope that he could be a world-class holding midfielder, because he had the engine and he had the brawn and he was tall too. And not a lot of great holding midfielders necessarily are tall. But he has just always lacked the positional discipline to play that. And that, I think, more largely is because he kind of lacks the discipline to follow a game plan. And players like that tend to occasionally lose their heads and get into trouble and see that red mist a little bit descend over them. This is not unusual for Fellaini. And in a sort of tense, tight game like that, I think that's liable to come out.
You know, before we move on to other topics, do you guys think this was a missed opportunity for Man City, with the way United didn't have all of its attacking options? They're playing at home. You know, they had the bulk of possession, and they had, you know, as I said, 19-3 shots advantage. It seems like City should have gotten something out of this other than, you know, just a point.
Yeah, as I said, I think this result really suited United because of that, because the cards were pretty much in City's deck here. You know, they're at home, they dominated possession. You've got United that's got, you know, three, four, how many key players on the injury bench? You know, Ibrahimovic, Pogba, Rojo. So yeah, I think it was a lost opportunity, and not that they had a whole lot to do, but City's much maligned defense did limit United's opportunities, but you got to look at Aguero and think.
And with Gabriel Jesus now back healthy, does Pep turn to him now that with Aguero not coming? It's one game, but
he came on. Maybe it was well offside, but he did score a goal. So I have a feeling that we're going to see Jesus restored to the starting lineup, and then we might see Aguero banished to the bench for the next game.
That's going to be interesting, though, because Aguero going into this game had, I believe, 12 goals in 12 games across all competitions. And he hit the post, didn't he? Or he came very close early on.
Yeah.
So, you know, he wasn't that far off. I think that'll be interesting. Also because Jesus was out for a long time. So it's going to take him a while to get fully match fit. So, you know, that might not be until one of the last games of the season. So that's worth watching. But a point I wanted to make, if City finds a goal here, they're on 67 points. So they lap Liverpool, take third place with a game in hand over now fourth place Liverpool, and United is 4 points back in fifth place, because they would be on 63 points. So, you know, if City had found a late winner somewhere, had found some kind of way of scoring a goal, they'd be home dry, I think.
Yeah, I think the statistics said that if City would have won today, it would have been a 99% certainty that they would be in the Champions League next year in one of those top four spots. And I think, you know, just to kind of tie this all together, look, and everyone agrees that the future for City is bright under Pep Guardiola. However, there are questions. And nobody in the Premier League has done the league double over Mourinho. It's happened in other countries, but it hasn't happened in the Premier League, which is notorious for being a little more, you know, rough and tumble, defensive minded, maybe less attacking talent. And for all the big names that Manchester City has, and that little diamond, or that 3-1 up top with Aguero and the misses he had today, De Bruyne has only scored twice since November, I think, something like that. Raheem Sterling is hit or miss here and there. With all those names up there, I think it's signaled more than ever that in going into a game where you knew you were going to have to break down a defensive-minded Mourinho side in Manchester United, it called more loudly than ever for new, different attacking talent. And obviously, Gabriel Jesus figures into that going forward. Obviously, there are still reinforcements that are needed elsewhere on the pitch, especially in the defense. But it also kind of laid bare that this is a problem that Manchester City is going to have to address.
So the status quo in this Manchester derby, well, it left the status quo of City being in fourth and United in fifth. City on 65 points, United on 64 points. Look who's in sixth, just 4 points back of United and 5 points back of City. It's Arsenal.
There they are. Creeping up on that fourth place trophy.
Do you guys think your Gunners are still in it for top four?
I want to start with you, Alex, because you think yes, and I think otherwise.
Yeah, I think they are, and I just think that this result really does play into their hand. And just the way Wenger's sort of thrown everything out the window, like he's going with the back three, they're scrapping out these results. They haven't played any pretty football for a while now. And I don't even really want them to. I want them to not. I want them to fail by every possible standard.
You want them to fail because you're ready for change.
Yeah, I don't want an FA Cup. I don't want to get into the Champions League and get knocked out in the round of 16. I want a new manager for Arsenal. But well, today just paves the way. And if they get a good result over Tottenham, I do see them creeping into fourth.
I think that you need more of a spine than this Arsenal team has in terms of through the middle. You know, I'm not trying to call out their manhood or anything when I say that. I'm speaking strictly in terms of the personnel that's up the middle on this team. And when you look at the teams that were able to kind of race back into the top four, I think it was 2013 or 2014, one of those 2 years where the players actually caught flack for celebrating getting in fourth barely over Everton. With a win at Newcastle, and if I recall correctly, that's like 2 or 3 years ago.
That was 2013.
Was that 2013? Yeah. But yeah, you know, so this has happened before. However, you also need someone to be complicit in that, and Everton really fell off late in that season, even though that was, I think, Roberto Martinez's one season where he was really successful with Everton. They didn't play well late, and you know, City, for as much problems as they had today, again, a win would have made it a mathematical near certainty that they would finish top four. And if Tottenham wins on Sunday, then that will officially be the first time in 22 years that Arsenal will not finish above Tottenham, because it will be mathematically impossible. You know they're not going to catch Chelsea. So there's three teams right there that you have to beat out to get into the top four that you literally could not beat out if one result had fallen different today. And so then you're talking about chasing Liverpool in fourth. And yes, Arsenal has games in hand on the run-in, but you know, you can't always count on those games in hand going your way. And by the way, you've got to beat Tottenham at White Hart Lane this weekend to start, which is going to be a very difficult task to begin with.
Speaking of big derby games, I mean, you know, like we were saying, City could have locked up a Champions League spot, but the stakes here at Spurs and Arsenal are potentially even bigger. If Spurs loses, I think they're probably out of the title race. And if Arsenal loses, they're really in trouble for getting back into the top four. I mean, this is a make-or-break game for each of these teams.
Yeah, and I look at the run-in, and I think an interesting point that needs to be made about it is, if Arsenal gets results this weekend and the next week against Manchester United, then you have two away fixtures for in the Premier League. But I actually think it might be a good thing, because you ask yourself, when you are playing for something late in the season, who do you want to play? You don't want to play the top six teams that are fighting for something like Arsenal. You also don't want to necessarily play the bottom feeders who are scrapping to avoid relegation, because while they're in that position for a reason, they also have a lot to play for. They want to stay up. You want to play like 8th through 13th. You want to play like right in the middle of the table where there's nothing that they're looking for. And those two away fixtures for Arsenal following this weekend again at Tottenham and then home to Manchester United are Southampton and Stoke City, who both kind of fall into that little area. You know, they're not scrapping for relegation. They're not going to come close to European spots. So that's where you really want to focus your attention. Then the next week after that, Arsenal's got Sunderland at home, and Sunderland is already down. So you're basically, I mean, maybe not mathematically, but I think we can all pencil them in for going to the Championship next season. So then you're talking about one more home game against Everton, which again is kind of in that same window. the problem with all these matches is there's like five of them within 2 weeks to finish the season because of Arsenal being in the FA Cup and other matches being delayed here and there. So these games in hand are really not balanced at all. They're going to be all dumped basically on the Gunners late in the season. And because even though I do think that they're fixtures where you can get points out of them, because the squad is so thin relative to the other big clubs in England and even in Europe, because of that, I think it's going to be really difficult to manage that slate of fixtures, and I think there's just going to be too much has to go right for the Gunners to get back into the top four, and I don't think it's going to happen.
Tottenham's won eight straight, and it's going to be a tough task for Arsenal to go and get even a point at White Hart Lane. But if you can think positively, Joey, just kind of envision how the Gunners could pull this off somehow and actually, you know, come away with 3 points. How is Arsenal, what are they going to need? Who's going to have to step up for them to pull off the upset?
Well, it's kind of become, you know, a broken record, but Alexis Sanchez is the one true difference maker in this Arsenal team. And one thing they are also going to have to do, the last couple matches have really seen Nacho Monreal get forward. This back three that seems to be doing, you know, it's done a pretty good job. It faced Manchester City in the FA Cup and did well there. You know, it got a little lucky the other night against Leicester, but 3 points is 3 points. I wonder if a different defensive formation with the possibility of a Rob Holding, who's not a very experienced Premier League player, and a Nacho Monreal, who likes to get forward a lot, I wonder if that's the best recipe, combined with the fact that it's a formation they're only playing for the third time ever, basically, going to White Hart Lane and facing Harry Kane and Dele Alli and all the attacking power that Tottenham has. I think that discipline is going to be very important. And I think that Wenger has to be realistic about this. He was always infamous in the past for when he has big away matches, maybe this is a strength and a weakness. He talked himself into thinking that Arsenal has a chance in all those matches. Now, obviously, that was flagrantly untrue in some of the matches that we've seen in recent years, and even in recent months, like the away match to Bayern Munich in the Champions League. They had no chance to win that game or get a result there unless they set up and packed it in. And I don't think that Arsene Wenger is going to do that necessarily. So I think that discipline in the way that that they play the formation, if they do choose to continue with this back three that's been working, you know, to be fair, it's gotten two wins, so it's not exactly been a disaster, but it could be against the right personnel, and I fear that Tottenham is the quote-unquote right personnel to expose it.
I think it's gotten 3 wins, hasn't it?
Is it 3? I could be wrong about the timeline on that.
I think the last time before, a couple weeks ago, Wenger used the back three was like 1996 or 97, and and that was because Tony Adams had yelled at him for switching to a back four, so he went to a back three for a while. I like what it's bringing out in Monreal. As you say, it's allowed him to get into these positions to either score goals or score goals off Robert Huth. and actually, I like the way it's working for Oxlade-Chamberlain, who, you know, when Arsenal were here last summer, I think Shahan and I both wrote about how Oxlade-Chamberlain was looking good, and we thought he was going to have a good season. And he is having a good season, maybe not in the way that I thought he was going to become this goal and assist-making guy, but he's really turned into this kind of jack-of-all-trades positionally. But this kind of wing-back position, I think, really suits him well because he's great. He makes these deep runs. His service has improved. So I think, you know, you're going to need to see something big from him on Sunday. Of course, you know, Sanchez and Ozil, you could substitute either one of those guys. We're like, let's see the game-changing performance. And from the forwards, you know, we're just not. I mean, Walcott was just. I don't think he's going to start. I think he was probably in because he's probably not going to start on Sunday. But we need to see, you know, a big moment from Olivier Giroud. Danny Welbeck maybe is a guy who could get a start with his pace. I think he could do some damage against a very sturdy Tottenham defense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's going to require some big performances from guys all over the pitch, and probably Peter Cech. That Tottenham defense is difficult to contain. And maybe we've seen a little bit better from Gabriel Paulista.
Mm-hmm.
Has certainly looked better in the back three, but we know that he's pretty susceptible.
That's the thing. Tottenham's going to – they are going to be well aware. The team, the staff, the fans, that this will be the first year. They don't have to hear the Arsenal fans brag about St. Totteringham's Day officially if they get the win. And that White Hart Lane is going to be a cauldron. And while I agree that guys like Gabriel Paulista have been better, it's just he's kind of indicative of the strength and attitude of this team, which is to say it's not very strong. It doesn't always have the right attitude, and I just it could get ugly on Sunday.
Welcome to the FC Yah Arsenal podcast.
Somehow that's the best insight we've gotten so far.
This is what happens when you have two Arsenal fans on the pod.
Pessimism. Lots of pessimism.
Well, we can only hope that Sunday's game, you know, the one in Derby, is half as good as what we saw at the Bernabeu between Real Madrid and Barcelona. We would be remiss if we didn't give our thoughts just quickly on that fantastic El Clasico. That game just never disappoints, it seems like. I mean, it was the highest level of football, of soccer, that you could see. It had everything. You know, it had confrontations. You know, Casemiro still fouling people and staying on the pitch. We had great goals.
He's unred cardable.
we had even Rakitic, who knew had such a rocket left foot. You know, obviously Messi's game winner at the end. That was the most dramatic, you know, the most fitting dramatic ending you can have if you're a Barcelona fan. But just quickly, what are your guys' thoughts on Sunday?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we were talking before that we went on air about how today's Manchester Derby was a dud, and how a lot of these, you know, sort of Serie A derbies you used to get excited for oftentimes are 0-0s. But the Clasico seems to deliver season in and season out, and that one in particular was particularly memorable. And I'll say this about Sergio Ramos. In a game like that, it's a binary choice what's going to happen. He's either going to score a late header and win the game or get a red card. And in that game,
it was one or the other.
And he stayed true to form in that. But anyway, it was a fantastic game that I was sort of watching on my phone as I withstood possibly the worst LA Galaxy match I've ever watched. So let me say I have major schadenfreude to Shahan Ahmed, who was at the Bernabeu.
Soccer is one of the most theatrical games we have. There's so much drama within a given match, and if the two teams are great, then the better they play, the more storylines there are and the more potential for swings there are. And I thought just the roller coaster of emotions was what I'm going to remember about this match, because Real Madrid goes up 1-0 early, maybe not deservedly. It was kind of a sloppy goal, but Casemiro was there to poach, credit him. The second goal, their equalizer for Barcelona, was fantastic for Messi. And we all know that Barcelona basically has to win or else it'd be very difficult for them to catch Real Madrid. So that's happening in real time. You know, the pendulum is swinging in real time. And then you get the Rakitic goal, which was fantastic. You know, you could maybe say that Real Madrid should have closing down a little bit more. I don't know if that seems a little bit of a harsh criticism on my part. It was a great left-footed finish. Then Sergio Ramos is sent off, so Real Madrid's not trying to win the game necessarily anymore. They're just, we need one more goal so we can make sure that Barcelona doesn't, you know, we keep Barcelona at bay in the league. And then, you know, Marcelo makes one of his great runs and sends a ball into the box that's low and hard and not the best ball in the world, but James Rodriguez does really well to keep it down to score about 15 minutes after Barcelona went ahead on Rakitic's goal. And again, he did really well with the finish to make sure that it's down. And so now you're looking at the last 5-6 minutes of the match where Real Madrid has to do is see this out, which would be kind of, not miraculous, but it'd be a very good performance given the fact that your best defender was sent off. And then Messi, that man, again, you know, it was a brilliant finish in a very tight window of space. His celebration, I have nothing against Real Madrid, nothing whatsoever, but I thought his celebration of basically running over to the supporters and showing his jersey and being like, that's me, that's my name, was just kind of like a way to rub it in. And we love that about these rivalry games. We love how bitter they are. And again, when there is this well played, it'll be something that you remember for as long as you cover the game.
What was lost was the goalkeeping, the incredible saves on both sides, Ter Stegen and Navas. And Navas came up big late with a couple of saves. And it was just the caliber, the high quality of soccer that was being played. You know, I don't think you'll ever see a World Cup final played at that level. Mm-hmm. Like, we would have to luck into, you know, two sides, two countries with, you know, some of the best talent that you can find. And that's what makes the Champions League so great, is the best players are playing in Europe. And you get games, you know, like that. But the Clasico is, you know, it's that level. You know, when you got Real Madrid and Barcelona stocked with stars, it's just great. It's great to see. And you could see on Twitter, the hashtag El Clasico was trending well into, you know, the evening East Coast time. I don't think people were still talking about it because it was such an amazing game.
It was two teams, I think, risking it all and just going for it. And I think that game, we had that really nice midweek derby in Germany in the German Cup, Bayern and Dortmund. And then we had today's game.
If you're going to rank the derbies that we've had over this past week.
Obviously. Sure, you have to say number one was the Clásico. Number two was their Clásico.
Their Clásico in the
German Actually, I disagree slightly. The best derby that I saw was El Clásico, and then the second best one was when I rewatched El Clásico.
I think you could say it was a classic amongst Clásicos.
It was.
For sure.
The German Cup, the DFB Pokal semifinal, that was a surprise because of the way Dortmund came back. Bayern looked like they had that in the bag.
And then
I mean, Dortmund was overwhelmed. But, you know, Thomas Tuchel came into the game thinking that they had the momentum. He was trying to boost up his guys, give them confidence. He didn't see it in that first half, but in the second half, you definitely saw that with Aubameyang getting the winner.
You see that tweet by Pulisic's dad, though? Pulisic's dad, just make sure you don't drink any beer. Son.
Yeah,
no
yeah.
Beer.
That was great.
What's really funny there is that Pulisic can legally drink beer in Germany. He's over 18. There's no law there keeping him from actually being allowed to drink. And it's funny because I went to an international school in Belgium with a lot of American kids, and their families kind of grappled with this because in Belgium, you can legally drink beer when you're 14 and you can drink spirits when you're 16. So their parents were sort of programmed to keep their kids away from alcohol, but they were living in this country where it was actually allowed. So, like, a lot of families had difficult discussions about that. I'm just saying that officially, FC Yahoo's stance is that if Pulisic wants a beer, he's earned one and he's legally allowed to, and he shouldn't have to listen to his dad anymore.
But he should have a designated driver, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Right. So, before we came on, I posted a question to gauge what people wanted to talk about. And we had Manchester Derby, La Liga, and Premier League title races. So it was the second option. At the fourth, well, the third was MLS salaries, and then North London Derby. 40% at first is MLS salaries. So among the top earners, well, at least for 2017 compensation, at the top is Kaká of Orlando City. He pulls down a sweet $7.2 million. Sebastian Giovinco of Toronto FC is just behind him, 7.1. U.S. men's national team captain Michael Bradley of Toronto FC, he's third. He makes $6.5 million. And then you have Andrea Pirlo of New York City FC, the aging Andrea Pirlo. He's making close to $6 million, 5.9. And then his teammate David Villa, he's fifth for NYC FC. He's making $5.61. So there's a lot of guys who are making the top money who are contributing, and this is what Leander wrote in his post this week. They're producing like they should. But then you have guys like a Pirlo who are giving the league that, you know, that retirement label, that retirement league label, who aren't producing. He and Giovinco dos Santos, who's number six on the list, he's making $5.5 million with the LA Galaxy. They have a grand total of one goal and no assists this season, and they're fourth and sixth on the list. That was Leander. I mean, are there any other thoughts you had on this annual salary dump from the MLS players?
First of all, a little rant, because MLS owners in particular are prone to complaining that these numbers are out there, and the league itself has sort of made its peace with it. But they're always saying, well, those numbers aren't quite right, because sometimes transfer fees are worked into that number because they count against the salary cap in MLS. And so if a player is bought, let's say, for $1 million and signed to a four-year contract, he would count the transfer fee would count against the salary cap at $250,000 for each of those 4 years, sort of spreading it out over the course of the contract. So they say sometimes that is included in that number. So that's fair on the salary. Sometimes contracts are heavily bonus laden, and that's not accounted for. And sometimes salaries are bought down, so they're actually higher than you can say. Nonetheless, none of those owners, none of those teams that complain about the players' union putting these numbers out is actually willing to correct their record on this. So these are the numbers that we have to go with, which I always find that weird to say, well, it's wrong, but then not to give us the right answer. The other thing, when you assess these designated player contracts, by and large, especially the high name, the big name foreign guys or the national team stars, it's important, I think, to isolate them when you compare them amongst themselves. Because when you compare, you know, Michael Bradley making $6.5 million to guys like Benny Failhaber and Sasha Kljestan, I don't know exactly what they make, but I'm guessing it's somewhere between $500,000 and $1 million thereabouts. You can't really make that comparison because Bradley is not 10 or 11 times better than either of those guys. So you have to kind of judge them on their own merit, which is why I chose to only take the top 11, because it wouldn't make sense to compare them against some rookie who's making $150,000. But what really struck me about doing this number is that other than Andrea Pirlo, and even he got 11 assists last year, and this was often different in the past, I can't find too many of these super high-earning guys for whom you can't make a justifiable case that they're kind of worth that money when you consider the DP scale that they're on.
Yeah, I mean, Dos Santos, you know, Joe, is a particular pet peeve of ours because he's been pretty much absent, even when he's been in games. But he was the Galaxy's leading goal scorer and assist maker last season, and, you know, still kind of waiting for him to get started. You know, Major League Soccer is an unusual league, and we've basically got the top six guys earn more than the combined payroll of four clubs, Houston, Montreal, D.C., and Minnesota. So you've got this sort of uneven dispersion of wealth and money throughout the league that they're trying to sort of correct with things like TAM money and trying to bring in these sort of, you know, guys on like Ashley Cole money or on guys like Jermaine Jones are getting these pretty big contracts, bigger than the average guy that's not, a DP player. So they're trying to sort of disperse the talent more throughout the league. I don't quite know what to make of the salaries. So is it the best thing for the U.S. team in a way that these guys come here and they make all this money? I mean, I understand you have to look out for your own interests, and if it's a question of like $2 million in Rome or $6 million in Toronto, then you go to Toronto. But
I just question how some of the money is being spent. I mean, Colorado uses $2.5 million on Tim Howard, who, you know, goalkeeping is essential, but do you really want to spend $2.5 million? Obviously, a lot of what goes into it is the marketing aspect. They feel like bring in a big name who's played in England. He's a U.S. men's national team legend, if you want to go that far, from what he did against Belgium in the 2014 World Cup. But, I mean, and then, you know, Alejandro Bedoya for Philadelphia, he's getting over $1 million, and he's their highest paid, I believe. I understand, you know, what he brings. But looking at what teams have done, yeah, he's not a creative type player. Like, they should be using this money to not just, you know, to improve their attacks. And that improves the quality of play for the league. I know, you know, Don Garber's not going to throw down an edict saying this is how you're supposed to use your money. But you see this with how Atlanta United is, you know, Chicago brought in this Nemanja Nikolic, who's making $1.9 million, and he's scoring goals for Chicago in addition to, I mean, when you had a Bastian Schweinsteiger, that really helps. But that's my biggest pet peeve with it. It's how the teams are spending the money. When, obviously, for me, it looks like it could be used in something that's more valuable, which is, you know, improving their attack.
Historically, there has been some guideline from the league on what deals are okay and which are not. Toronto FC at one point tried to sign Olav Melberg from Aston Villa, a Danish defender, if I'm not mistaken, for a few million a year. And the league just said, no, we're not going to do that. And one prominent former MLS goalkeeper, who I'm not going to name, told me that there was pretty much a rule that they weren't going to spend real DP money on a goalkeeper until Howard became available. So that there was that to an extent. But I think when they brought Michael Bradley back, they kind of broke that barrier, because, you know, it was an understandable thing to do what they did in 2014. It was before the World Cup. They brought back Bradley and Dempsey and a few other national teamers, and they were the guys on the national team at that time. And Bradley was someone who could help turn Toronto around. But I think once they allowed the Bradley deal through, they really didn't have an argument anymore for paying non-creative players. But yeah, I think there's an understanding that for any guy making more than, say, $2 million in MLS, whatever they're paid over that amount isn't for what they're going to do on the field. You know, it's for credibility, and it's for the press that they're going to get, and it's for selling jerseys, and it's for drawing people to the stadium. And, you know, you can trifle with that, and people certainly have. But I think that being a retirement league of sorts and paying those guys and bringing them over, even if they're doing less and less of it, has worked out really well for MLS. Because, you know, the other day when the players union dumped its salaries, I noticed that, like, Dutch soccer Twitter was talking about MLS salaries. Like, there were lots of Dutch soccer people discussing them and talking about, and granted, there's a few Dutch players in the league, but I don't know that that sort of thing happens, that the league takes off quite so quickly that it gets as much interest as it does now if it never starts the DP rule and if it doesn't consciously overpay for guys like that.
If you're wondering who is the best bargain for 2017, right now, so obviously it's Kyle Lahren in Orlando City. He's got 6 goals and he's only making $192,000. So before we get out of here, shout out to Omar Gonzalez, who helped Pachuca win the CONCACAF Champions League title last night over Tigres. He's the only player to win MLS Cup, Liga MX, and the CCL titles. And, you know, Omar got caught up in this crazy MLS salary structure when they were wanting to bring in Gio and Gerard. They paid, I think, initially that they paid his salary with TAM money, and then they asked him to take this like 50% pay cut. But, you know, Omar needed to leave. We had seen Omar kind of enjoy his comfort zone. He was this 2011 when they beat Houston for the MLS Cup. You know, he had that great header goal, and his, you know, the future was bright for him. And, you know, even he said in a story that Grant Wall did on him last year, he was content. He was complacent, and he needed to move on to improve. And it's weird in Europe, you don't hear players saying at age 28 that they're getting better. That pretty much you are who you are. You are the finished article by the time you get to 28. But I think that's something unique with American players. It's just great to see Omar succeed. You know, he won the College Cup with Maryland, and the LA Galaxy won 3 MLS Cups. He's doing well with Pachuca. And, you know, when the World Cup qualifying comes around again next month, he has to be in the squad.
He's won everything there is to win on this side of the pond, basically, with your club team, now that he's won the CONCACAF Champions League. And he's only 28, and the trial he had when he had a tryout with Nuremberg I think it ended because he tore his ACL because he collided knees with his national teammate Timmy Chandler in an unfortunate stroke of luck or misfortune, whatever you want to call it. And I just wonder if this thing about him being complacent was true then, how does it not necessarily creep in now? And obviously you can't put a price on happiness. And if he really has settled into Mexico and he's really happy playing down there, then that's great. And he shouldn't leave just to try to win something in Europe. But if that is true, what I said about the complacency and what you brought up, and that's how his one trial in Europe ended, you got to think maybe there is a little bit of fire under him that maybe go back over there and say, well, I've done everything I can over here. If I don't end up working out over there, it's okay. You know, I'm sure there's going to be landing spots for me back here. And even if there isn't, I've already won everything I can win. I wonder that about him.
You know, I think Omar, I think Europe is, if it's there, if the opportunity is there, I think Omar would jump at it. I think that's something he's, you know, obviously with the trial with Nuremberg, I mean, that was something that he wanted to explore. Where the way he's playing right now, I think you know, I think he understands what it takes now to, you know, nothing is ever taken for granted because he had to push himself at Pachuca because he's got guys behind him who will take his spot. At the Galaxy, he didn't have that threat. You know, he knew he was going to play every day. He knew he was going to get picked for the U.S. men's national team until his play, you know, proved that he wasn't worthy of that. So for me, I would like to see Omar take on that challenge. So that was the only thing that's left for him you know, as far as club football, you know, is concerned.
I was told that 5 years or so ago, I'm guessing, he had a big offer from Russia but turned it down.
There could be any number of clubs back then.
Yeah.
They were paying Samuel Eto'o to play out in one of the worst places in the world. <Yeah.
laughs> I'd hold out for an offer from China if I were him, if that's the case.
All right. I think that's going to wrap this podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the FC Yahoo podcast on iTunes, and also please give us a review. For Alex Baker, Joey Galino, Leander Charles-Atkins, this is Joe Lago. Thanks for listening to the FC Yahoo podcast. We'll catch you next time. Thanks.